And then if you just take election probabilities, that would imply, if you anchor that, I think Buttigieg and Biden were like 2,700. Because again, they're going to come in and raise taxes. That's going to cause probably some economic contraction. So that would imply that Donald Trump, if he gets reelected, the S&P is worth 3,600. So as an investor, you have to have a view on the election because the outcomes are so extreme. I've never seen this kind of polarity in the elections as we have now. And they always say, oh, well, doesn't make any difference who president is. You know, the markets rally 53% of the time when they're Democrats and 52% of the time. It does make a difference. Ronald Reagan, when he became president, was a huge difference to the stock market. And I would say who the next president is also going to have a huge impact on the economy, the stock market, particularly asset prices. Because clearly, asset prices today, whether it's U.S. stocks, whether it's interest rates, whether it's the dollar, it's all priced off of, in my opinion, a 5% budget deficit with this incredibly overly stimulative fiscal policy combined with this overly stimulative monetary policy is creating this U.S. exceptionalism that one day, like if we normalize our deficit to where Europe is right now, would have a completely different valuations for the stock market, valuations for the dollar. The dollar would be substantially lower, I believe. So this next presidential election and what policies they pursue afterwards, I think this one is going to be more meaningful than anyone, certainly in my lifetime. So it's going to be really
I agree with you. So I'm mechanistic. I'm not ideological. I'm just mechanistic. So I just go through the calculations. And if you take away corporate taxes and change, the undoing of that, that's worth 7 or 8%. If you take the changes in GAAP accounting, changes in the taxes for corporations, that's worth about 15% of earnings, and a little therefore would drop another basis of that alone. If you take then the wealth tax is $2.8 trillion over 10 years, and so that'll have an effect. So it is, and then that doesn't have to do with regulation and the changes in regulation. I think we are dealing with the question, like 30, is it populism of the left or is it populism of the right, and how is that going to work? And that's not just an American issue. It's a UK issue in Jeremy Corbyn. It's a UK. So we have an issue in terms of that politics will certainly matter to asset prices. But at the same time, I'm saying, we have not made capitalism work for the average person. You and I spent a lot of time talking about philanthropy, and Paul really has taught me a lot, and he's been a role model for me through the Robin Hood Foundation of being able to do all sorts of things. And then we have Just Give and other things that he's done. So he and I know and really deeply believe in the fact that the system is unfair and is in many cases uneconomical, because what is the economic? How is it economically sensible to not have to spend the money to get kids through high school, those disadvantaged and disengaged kids? Just to put that there, it's such a pleasure to deal with the governor of the state of Connecticut to be able to cost effectively kids through high school. Because it's relatively economic, it's cheap to do that. And yet the cost duration, state, I think the numbers spends on incarceration, the probability of what that changes in their life, in terms of what their lives are like, what their impact in terms of crime, we talk about crime in Hartford, Connecticut, and those things, and the cost on the society, the cost on the environment, makes that a peanuts type of expenditure. And the government doesn't do those things.
So when you look at the well-being of the country, and you look at what are the things that determine a country that is that goes bad well, you have to have something that's a fair system that strikes for something like equal opportunity, and you have to have something that invests in education and those kinds of things to make a healthier society. So we have both of those that are things that are existing. That I think the key question is whether we're going to be able to come together not demonize each side. You know, in other words, there's a demonization and there's a split that's going on, and there's not a thoughtfulness in terms of how to engineer it. Because we can make those high increases. You know, in terms of your programs and I'm looking at my programs, that the economic return on investment of finding those things that could be done that educate people and so on, the all-in return on those investments are excellent. But you have when you have a state that can't have a budget, they can't invest in education. So we need to re-engineer that. But the we is the key question: will we do it together? Or will we do it like we're going to kill each other, and that'll have capital flows implications, because we're going to run large budget deficits. And then if you capital stays where they like capitalism, and capitalism needs to be fixed. And if you don't fix it, you're going to have a revolution. And if you and then you're going to also chase the capitalists away.
Yeah. So. Just so we're clear, to me, that fixing capital is so easy. There's 50 years ago, 6.5% of corporate revenues went to shareholders. Today, that number is 13%. Why did it go from 6.5%, where it's been fairly stable for since the war? Why did it go to 13%? Milton Friedman said in 1970, the purpose of a corporation is to maximize profits. Then Gordon Gekko, famously, in 1987, said greed is really on the Americans. Greed's got us wealth disparity that's five times where it was 50 years ago. And greed has created the greatest divisiveness this country's ever had. And so shareholders, the shareholder primacy, if you just think about it, there's $2 trillion of corporate profits. 50 years ago, a trillion of that would have gone to employees, the 90 million American workers. It would have gone to communities. It would have gone to saving the planet. It would have gone to customers. But now it goes to increasingly the 1%. And it wasn't by design. It wasn't a plebiscite. And it wasn't because bad people or because good people did bad things or anything like that. It was unfortunately just a natural, unchecked movement because of the fact that we as a culture thought business is where you make your money and that's all that you do. 45% of our waking time that we're not eating or that we're not recreating or commuting is spent at work. We're never gonna fix the social problems that address us today if we do not start in the workplace. And the easiest place to start is we have 6 million employees of public companies that today do not make a living wage, that live under the poverty line. 6 million. Hopefully organically, we can make everyone think, okay, whether I'm a shareholder or I sit on a board, I have an employee that's not making a living wage, and yet we're paying ourselves dividends, we're engaging in share buybacks, et cetera. Is that really the American way? Is that fair? Shouldn't I first be thinking about that group of stakeholders that are so critical? And just remember, those 6 million employees that are living under the poverty line are being subsidized, right, by all of us in this room. So it's actually a tax on the rest of society to have a worker that works for your company that doesn't make a living wage. So I'm so excited that we're talking about stakeholder capitalism, so that we can begin to move back to that balance where we were 50 years ago. Just one last thing. 50 years ago, oh, by the way, in 1969, 1968, 1967, when shareholder profits were 6.5% of the pie, GDP was double what it is right now. It was double what it is right now. So you can, it's, if you think about blank sheet of paper, if we're solving for the perfect society, what level of profits and compensation do we need to have to encourage Ray Dalio, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, the entrepreneurs of the world to go create businesses? Is it, does it have to be where it is right now with this enormous striation between the least paid and the highest paid? And again, another question would be CEO pay. If a question that I would ask as a shareholder and as a director is, how many employees do we have not making a living wage relative to what I am paying the CEO? It's a legitimate cultural, social, moral, ethical question to ask. And hopefully we're going to start asking that in every damn boardroom.
I don't think that's going to work. Well, what I mean is,
this is the same discussion you and I had last year on the wagon. Not that wagon, but the quail wagon.
I think everybody has their own particular way of dealing with it. And so everybody sort of says, do it this way, do it that way.
Do you think we need legislation?
Let me tell you what.
Okay. I know what you told me once.
Okay. I think we need to do it together. I think that there's, look, everybody's got their way of doing it, and everybody's backbiting their other way. And everybody, we have to do it, first of all, if it was done together. I think the President of the United
100%
States.
100% agree.
That the President of the United States should declare it an emergency or somebody. The only thing that matters is who has their hands on the legislative power. Nothing's going to happen. We can scream all we want to have it. We all have our own. So putting that together, bring in all the constituents, people who are both non-economically, and also are on the ground. You know, we know Jeff Canada, Harlem Children's Home. That's a man who is knows what it's like to be on the ground, because we people can be just theoretical, thinking we know it better. No, you want to learn from those people on the ground, and then you want to engineer it together. I would lock them up in a place for 6 months and say, if you can't come out of that place until you reach an agreement that is both smart, that increases the size of the pie, and also divides the pie well. Because I believe that there are a lot of high return on investment things. Like if you look at the all-in return on education or something, if it's done well. I don't think we're gonna do that. I think that's what's required. But I don't think we're gonna do that. I think we're gonna try to kill each other. We're now in an environment in which, I have a principle, which is when the cause that you are behind is more important to you than the system for resolving your disputes, the system is in jeopardy, right? That's what the situation we are. The causes in the battle is more important to all those people to get their way than the systematic way of working together to try to say, how do we be in this together to resolve that? So I think that's what you need.
Yeah, needless to say, we wouldn't have spent all our time that we did in the not-for-profit causes if we didn't think that there were a whole variety of bottoms-up ways of attacking this problem with true practitioners on the ground. So that I agree with. And I do think it's going to take a combination of changing what we do in philanthropy and amplifying that. You see, the reason why I get so focused on the private sector side and companies in particular is philanthropy is $400 billion. the federal government's $4 trillion, and business is $16 trillion. So business is 40 times the size of private philanthropy. So we've got to use all three working together exactly the way you said, expand the pie, maximize each of those three different sectors so that we can go back to having a country that is united and happy and tolerant and loving and giving towards each other. We have the greatest country in the whole world. We just need, as you say, to take the time, bring the intellectual capital, and get us back on track.
I think it's time for us to go.
Okay, all we are is what we are for each other. It's good news. Broadcast, good news. Planet. Great job. That's a nice tour. All right, that's it.